sweets. Only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school. My household smell like soul food, bruh. Curry falafel.
What's up, Beardos? Welcome to episode 91 of The Bearded Vegans. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes at thebeardedvegans.com. And you can always reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we will talk about what we've been eating, go over the news, ask the question, do we need a vegan flag? And then conclude with an interview with Wendy Werneth, better known to the world as the Nomadic Vegan.
I love your inflection on, do we need a vegan flag?
Thank you, Andy.
Great question asking inflection, Paul.
Well, all too often, I feel like I don't phrase the question as a question. I'd kind of say it as a statement, so... I'm just trying to flip things around a little bit.
I appreciate your effort.
Thank you. So, what have you been eating, Andy?
I had a very busy weekend this past weekend. On Saturday, I was at Compassion Fest in Hamden, Connecticut, which is an event that is very near and dear to my heart because Connecticut doesn't have a lot of vegan events.
Yep.
There was an ill-fated Connecticut Veg Fest many years ago. Mm-hmm. One time only. So thankful to Compassion Fest for kind of stepping up to the plate and filling that need. It's in its third year. It's been growing every year. This time they landed some really, really fantastic vendors, some out-of-state vendors that I love, like Yeah Dog, who I know we talk about all the time, and Like No Udder. And they had a vendor that's new to New Haven, Connecticut, where I used to live, but I haven't had a chance to try it yet, and that's the Ninth Square Caribbean Market.
Oh, you haven't tried that yet?
I have not tried it yet. Somehow it has eluded me, even though it's like my favorite type of food and in the city that I used to live in and often pass through. And I got a plate that was the rice and peas and some brown stew soy chunk of some kind. But what really stood out to me, some might call it the star of the show, Paul.
Some might.
Were these curry chickpeas.
Ooh.
These were so good. They reminded me of the curry from Reggae Shack in Gainesville, which is one of my all-time favorites. And, you know, normally I'm not one to be excited about something like that. Like, it's kind of standard, I guess. But they did it so well. It was, like, the third item that I was like, I guess I'll get this. And it's the one that I ended up liking the most. So I can't wait to go and check out their actual location. I've been told you get a ridiculous amount of food for a very fair price there.
I can attest to that.
What do you think of Night Square? You've been there?
I have. I actually haven't been to the actual place, but I've gotten takeout from there, I think, three times, and each time is better than the last. It's so everything. I love everything. I think it might be one of my new favorite places in Connecticut.
Wow. Strong praise.
Oh, yeah.
Is your favorite your kitchen where you make Gardein crispy tenders?
And or plain tofu in a George Foreman grill? Absolutely.
And at Compassion Fest, the Beardos were out in full force. So thank you to Rachel, Carrie, Jackie, Nick, Kurt, and Jeff, who, funny story, Paul, Jeff went vegan because of Penn Jillette.
Whoa.
And I love that Penn Jillette has become a recurring theme on our podcast.
We'll get him. We'll interview him one of these days. I'm disappointed that I couldn't make Compassion Fest. I know. I think every episode before then, I said that I was going to be there, and I was not.
What were you doing, Paul?
Well, I was planning on being there because originally I was supposed to move to Philadelphia on the Sunday, and Compassion Fest is on the Saturday. But instead, it got pushed forward. I moved on that day, that Saturday. So I am now currently in my apartment above a pizza place in Philadelphia that does serve vegan pizza.
But it's not Blackbird.
But it's not Blackbird, unfortunately.
I'm disappointed in you, Paul.
Well, I say unfortunately, but more about that in a little bit. But so I was moving. The move went well. If you hear the sounds of trucks and passerbyers, it's probably because they are right outside of my window. So apologies for that. But yeah, I love it here so far. There's probably 50 places that have vegan options within a 10 or 15 minute walk of my apartment. It's honestly incredible. Every coffee shop sells Dottie's Donuts or other vegan baked goods. Yesterday I went to the Triangle Tavern. which I've heard is a good place. I got this roast beef sandwich, and it was actually, it was the seitan that Blackbird uses. And they kind of like shave it up into thin slices. It was pretty good. It was honestly very similar to a Blackbird Philly cheesesteak, just minus the cheese sauce and plus this kind of vegan mayo that they had on the side. It was still good though. And then I have been to Blackbird, Andy, and I finally tried that new Via Life cheese and was not as impressed as everyone is making it out to be, unfortunately.
Gasp. Audible gasp.
I'm definitely going to give it another shot, maybe two or three more shots a week, but
for science.
Yeah, for science. I still had that Philly cheesesteak, still good. I didn't get the wings yet. I'm sure those are still delicious, but geez, I don't know. Everyone's been raving about it. I'm going to give it another shot.
Well, that's your bi-monthly Blackbird update from Paul.
And soon to be weekly.
Yeah, basically, if any beardos in Philly want to meet Paul, just go camp out at Blackbird for about 24 hours or less, and you will find him.
Most certainly.
Yes, and so, Paul, I wrapped up the weekend. I went down and did the vegan pop-up shop in Asbury Park, which is put on by the wonderful folks at the New Jersey Veg Fest. And this is the coolest location for an event of this kind. And this is a venue that's a music venue. And so the vendors are just kind of set up on where the audience would be standing looking at the stage, essentially. And it's like surrounded by like stadium seating so people could grab their food and go sit in the stadium and watch all the throngs of vegans descending upon all the delicious treats, including vegan treats who had their standard, 2-hour line. And, it's right on the boardwalk. It's like you walk outside of the venue and you can see the ocean and the beach, and there's just like people jogging with their dogs, and the boardwalk like has to go through this building where the entrance to this pop-up shop was. So it's like a very, very cool location, and they got more people than they were expecting. They had to turn away about 700 people actually. So vegans out in full force. Didn't know Asbury Park had such a strong vegan draw.
That's awesome.
There were many food vendors that I did try. A lot of them are regulars on the show, so I won't mention. But I did get to finally try Nature Has Flavor, who was serving Hannah's meatballs. And they had several different sauces that you could put on them. They had the traditional marinara with some vegan parm, which we got and was very good. But the thing that I loved was they had an option where you could have it with teriyaki sauce and then like a drizzle of spicy mayo and some crispy garlic on top. Yeah, so good. It's not like a gourmet meatball, but definitely like a very nicely done meatball. So that was Nature Has Flavor, and Beardo's at the pop-up shop in Asbury Park as well. So thank you to Cheech, Jeff, Tara, and Adele for coming out. It was awesome to meet everybody.
Nice of you to meet two celebrities, Andy.
Yes,
you didn't tell me about that.
It's funny, Paul, because the other food thing that I've been eating a lot this week is Gardein crispy tenders.
That's what I'm talking about.
Because my partner purchased an air fryer, and it's essentially an oven. It's not like really frying anything, but it's essentially like an oven that doesn't have any heat up time, and you can throw any like Gardein product in there for 10 minutes and it comes out perfect and crispy. So I feel like lately I've had a few beardos say that once they've seen videos of us talking, they thought that I was you, like my voice belonged to you. And now I'm starting to complete that transformation by consuming Gardein tenders most days out of the week.
Yeah, you said I'm eating a lot of Gardein tenders because my partner brought an air fryer. I think what you meant to say is I'm eating a lot of Gardein tenders because they're delicious and the best.
Also true. Very true. Very true. So with that food, that thrilling food report under wraps, Paul, I think it's time we move into the news.
All right. What do you got coming up first, Andy?
So this is something that just broke earlier today, actually. This is coming from an article at theguardian.com that has been reported on most major outlets that I've looked at. And so this article is titled "Humane Milk is a Myth, Veganism Advert Cleared by Standards Body."
Mouthful.
Which is kind of an awkwardly titled. So essentially this is something that's happened in the UK, and the article starts off by saying an advertisement stating that, quote, "humane milk is a myth has been cleared by the regulator following complaints from members of the dairy industry that it was inaccurate and misleading." And we'll post a link to this in the show notes so you can see what this ad actually is. But essentially, it features a picture of a cow, and there's barbed wire between like the viewer and the cow. And then there's a little bit of it says humane milk is a myth. And then it has a little bit about, you know, baby calves being taken away from their mothers, and the male calves being used for veal, things like that. Very, very sad, depressing picture. And so this came under fire from the dairy industry because they said it was misleading. So we're going to read a little more from that article before we talk about it. 7 complainants, some of whom had experience of working in the dairy industry and who believed that the advert did not accurately describe the way that dairy cattle were generally treated in the UK, challenged whether the claims were misleading and could be substantiated. Go Vegan World, who put out the advertisement, said that it did not state or imply that calves were separated from their mothers before the 12 to 24 hours recommended by the Department for Environment, Food, and Rural Affairs, acronym DEFRA. But in any case, they believe the exact timing of the separation was irrelevant to the ad, which commented on the injustice of separating cow and calf, claiming later separation actually caused more distress. They believed most people would consider separation at 25 hours as unjust as separation at 24 hours. So this is a kind of an interesting ruling. What do you think of this, Paul?
Yeah, I actually want to say, because it's funny because this is getting a tremendous amount of exposure, which you already kind of said that. But I first saw this because one of my Instagram friends from the UK, Abigail, she posted it on her Instagram story, and she actually sent me texts of, like, it was front page in a lot of, like, in the newspaper that she was reading. This was like the front page article, and it was like 3 pages worth of article. It continued on, and it was it's like, it's wild that it's getting this much exposure.
Yeah, I think this is obviously a good thing. We clearly don't want industries to be able to dictate that activists can't call milk inhumane, and that's, you know, one of the big battle points for a lot of activists is, should we be fighting for welfare or abolition and all of these things. And the RSPCA, which is the UK counterpoint to the ASPCA, the R over there stands for Royal instead of American. They have a representative who, in an article from ibtimes.co.uk, said it was incorrect for the advert to claim all dairy farming was inhumane, telling the paper, you can rear, transport, and slaughter an animal according to good welfare standards, and therefore they can be humanely eaten.
Huh.
So it's weird that you have animal rights advocates. I don't know exactly how one wants to qualify the RSPCA or the ASPCA, but do you think they could just, like, sit back and be like, we'll let the abolitionists have this one? Like, yeah. Do you think they had to step in and be like, no, you can still humanely herd animals, it's okay?
Yeah, it is weird because, although I guess the RSPCA would have the viewpoints, many of them would have the viewpoints that it's like, yes, there is humane ways to do things, this still seems like it would be in alignment with, like, what their ultimate goal would be, maybe, right?
Yeah, it just feels like a weird time to speak out.
Yeah, like you would think that this advertisement coming out in, like, would lead to better treatment of animals, whether or not that means, like, in a welfarist point of view or in an abolitionist point of view. But either way, if, like, steps towards either one of those are happening, wouldn't the RSPCA be in favor of that?
I guess maybe they're saying that if you just say blanketedly that there's no such thing as humane milk, then no one will try and reform the milk industry, and that cows will continue to live horrible lives if people don't try and make them a little bit better.
I guess that is what they're thinking. I feel like you said, I don't know why they couldn't just, like, step back and see what happens as a result of this, maybe.
Yeah. Stay in your lane, RSPCA.
When we critique welfare tactics and we say, this isn't actually going to do anything, this isn't actually going to work, isn't that what they could justify that they're doing? Is they're criticizing the abolitionist advocate for saying, and saying, this isn't going to, I'm not that they, yeah, I mean, isn't that what they're kind of saying too?
I mean, I can't take what they're saying as meaning anything other than, no, it's okay to continue to exploit animals.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is quite literally what they said. They said, you can do this. So, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, well, the final bit of the article says, the Advertising Standards Authority, which is the ones that made this ruling, said, although the language used to express the claims was emotional and hard-hitting, we understand it was the case that calves were generally separated from their mothers very soon after birth, and we therefore concluded that the ad was unlikely to materially mislead readers. So it's interesting how this was trying to be defended by the dairy industry. And this is something I encounter when I do talk with like agriculture students when I'm on college campuses doing outreach, is they kind of want to continue to argue and explain like how things aren't as bad as we think they are because this is like for their benefit or we're misleading about it. And they're like, no, they're not taking away 24 hours after birth. They're taking away 25 hours after birth. It's totally different. And so this, you know, ruling is essentially being like acknowledging that people will find it disturbing either way. And even if they took the baby away after a week or 2 weeks, at any point, taking the baby away from the mother is going to be considered disturbing. And therefore the advertisement rings true.
Yeah. No, like you said, it is interesting that they're not defending it by saying this is untrue. They're defending it by saying this is misleading.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point, Paul. And one final note is that that second article I was talking about ends by saying the ruling comes only a couple of months after dairy farmers lost an ASA case after the regulator ruled that advertising organic milk as, quote, good for the land was misleading. So dairy losing all sorts of battles on this front right now. And I'm sure that they're scared, and that's probably why they feel the need to kind of counteract these types of advertising or statements and all those things. One reason might be this next article that we have on the docket.
The next article comes to us from vegnews.com titled Vegan Ice Cream Industry to Reach $1 Billion in 2017. And reading from that article, a new report compiled by market research firm Future Market Insights, or FMI, predicts that the global plant-based ice cream industry will continue to grow to $2.45 billion by 2027. By the end of 2017, FMI values the dairy-free ice cream industry at $1 billion. And they said, the global plant-based ice creams market is likely to experience rising growth opportunities due to an increasing lactose intolerant population and rising adoption of veganism. So veganism getting a little shout out there. And Andy, I don't know about you, but I definitely feel like in the last year, I was going to say year or two, but I even feel like it's just been this last year. It's like everyone is scrambling to get onto the vegan ice cream game.
They're all trying to get that sweet, sweet vegan money.
And while this is, you know, this is, I would say on its surface, this is a good thing. It's good that this vegan industry is growing. I think we also still need to be wary because it's like, as I'm sure listeners of the podcast know, as we've said before, it's like just because something's vegan doesn't necessarily mean it's ethical or it's cruelty free. And we would always encourage people to check out the Food Empowerment Project's chocolate list, which can be found at foodispower.org/chocolate-list, where they basically have contacted all different companies that use, vegan companies that use chocolate. They've contacted them to basically determine the source of their chocolate because they know if their chocolate is sourced from certain areas, it's most likely from slave labor. And so they've kind of ranked them into categories like, we would recommend this. We wouldn't recommend this because of this reason. We wouldn't recommend this because the company never got back to us, and et cetera. And interestingly enough, or I should say, unfortunately, Ben and Jerry's, they said they can't recommend their chocolate, but it did say that Ben and Jerry's are working on it, which I'm not exactly sure what that entails. And then the newest vegan ice cream, which is the Häagen-Dazs, they said just a flat out, they do not recommend them because Häagen-Dazs is owned by Nestle, which does not make very ethically sourced chocolate.
Yeah. And sadly, the new Breyers not on that list either.
Yeah. Well, Breyer's just not even on the list at all. I would imagine there may be in the process of contacting Breyer's. But Andy said this to me before we started recording. I mean, these kind of huge companies like Breyer's, I mean, it would be great if we find out that their chocolate is sourced from an ethical location. But I mean, just from what we've seen, these larger companies tend to focus more on what ways they can cut costs than being ethical. So not high hopes for Breyer's.
Yeah, so this is kind of a double-edged sword. Like, it's like, oh, yay, vegan ice cream is more popular than ever. It's going to continue to grow, but at what expense? Mm-hmm. It's one of those tough things. It's something we try and balance out on the show all the time is, like, you know, if someone's a new vegan and they're all excited and they want to learn about what they can eat and they're like, oh, even at my Walmart, I can find the Breyer's. And then you're like, well, actually, and, you know, it's a very complicated thing. But if people do want to learn more about it, I would suggest going all the way back to episode 2, where we interviewed Lauren Ornelas, who is the founder of the Food Empowerment Project.
And you know who is on the recommended list is So Delicious, who I believe their cashew ice cream to be the best anyways. So I'm going to stick with that one.
They are mighty fine. Mighty fine. So that was our attempt at putting some positive news into the show today. Slightly positive. And Paul, you found this ad, a very interesting ad that's getting a variety of reactions from a lot of people that are not vegan. So tell us about this ad.
So this comes to us from independent.co.uk. titled KFC, the whole chicken advert causes outrage. And just so you know, the whole chicken is in quotes because that is the name of the advertisement. So basically what this is an advertisement that KFC put out. It is the first advertisement that they've put out since switching ad agencies. And from what the article says, it seems like they were very proud to put out this advertisement. We'll see if they change that to kind of respond to some of the negative feedback they've gotten. But here's reading from the article. The whole chicken, the name of the advertisement, features some sassy white hens strutting around a warehouse to X Gon' Give It To You by DMX with the aim of underlining that KFC products are 100% chicken. So Andy, I watched this advertisement and I guess until the very, very end when like, it's a minute long advertisement. It is a long advertisement. And only at the very, very end when it says like the whole chicken and not nothing but the whole chicken or something like that, I was like, I don't get what angle they're trying to go for right now. It's just a minute of chicken footage, just chickens kind of walking around and then DMX playing in the background. And when I first watched it, I thought that it was going to be like, they were trying to go for like a chicken fight type thing. Like it was going to be one chicken because it's like makes the chicken seem really tough. Like they're giving these kind of like glaring at the camera and stuff like that. And I thought it was going to be one chicken comes out and then like another chicken comes out and they fight or something. And that's what I thought was when I read the article, when I read the title, it caused outrage. I thought that's what it was, but no, it was just chickens, just like footage of chickens and DMX playing in the background. Very strange.
Paul, I have to say, up until the KFC logo, I was like kind of digging this video.
Yeah. So
like it's just some sassy chicken strutting around to some DMX.
Well, you know who else was kind of digging this video or would kind of have dug the video if it had not been for KFC is PETA. And in the article, it actually says PETA, a spokesperson for PETA, said that they compared this advertisement to one of their own advertisements, essentially saying that, I guess for lack of a better word, it humanized the chickens, and it seemed like an advertisement that would be like, look at how beautiful and smart and majestic these animals are. Like you should not be eating them. And so essentially, PETA was saying, it besides not showing, you know, footage of slaughterhouses or something like that, this could have been a PETA ad up until the very end when those words came up. And so, yeah, basically the article is saying that the advertisement has provoked a lot of outrage because a lot of people think it's disgusting for exactly the reason that PETA was just saying that, it showed a lot of tweets from people saying like, well, now I feel guilty about eating chicken, or like, well, this advertisement makes me not want to eat chicken anymore. And obviously people are quick to say that kind of stuff on the internet. And I don't think most of them were serious or would seriously go vegan or vegetarian, but it is just kind of interesting that this advertisement for a chicken product was kind of turning people off from chicken. And of course, The Independent is selecting which tweets to show, and so they chose a lot of ones where people were saying that kind of stuff. They also showed some where people were like, oh, this advertisement was genius, this was a great advertisement. But the positive feedback that they showed, those tweets, it wasn't like, I can't wait to eat chicken, or like, wow, KFC is such a great organization. I think the positive feedback was more like, this is a comical advertisement because it's just DMX playing under footage of chickens.
And who doesn't love some cute-ass chickens?
So the last thing I'll read, a KFC spokesperson told The Independent, our fans know that when they eat with us, it's all about the chicken, the whole chicken, and nothing but the chicken. So seeing one in our ad shouldn't come as a surprise. So it kind of still seems like at this point, KFC is like, yeah, this advertisement's sick. Like, this is a great advertisement. I wonder if they continue to get negative feedback, if they'll kind of reverse that policy and being like, whoops, sorry, we shouldn't be humanizing chickens. I keep saying humanizing chickens. Andy, what's the word that I'm looking for?
I mean, it's not humanizing. Like, that's not what I think people are upset about with the ad. Because, like, yeah, they're strutting down the hallway and giving some, like runway model looks at the camera occasionally. But yeah. Really, it's just kind of, it's animalizing the food that they're eating, I guess. Like, yeah, it's
giving
like
a face.
Saying, yes, it's giving a face to the food that people are consuming.
Which is, I mean, like, which is a, I think, powerful animal advocacy tool that now KFC is apparently using.
Yeah, it seems very ill-advised on their part, but I hope they really dig their heels in and keep doing it.
Yeah.
Like, I hope instead of them listening to this response and being like, maybe it's not good for business for us to remind people that they're eating the carcass of a pretty cool animal, and instead they're like, well, fuck these people, we're gonna really show them what's up, and then they just start using like slaughterhouse footage in their advertisements. Yeah.
Or they're like, look at how smart chickens are, they can do all these things.
Yeah, the article I think pointed out that chickens can count to five.
Yes, thank you, PETA.
That's the first time you'll ever hear Paul say that.
So yeah, I guess we'll see where this goes from here. Did you have any other response to this, Andy?
I don't know. It's just interesting how people are like aware enough to be like upset about this issue, but probably aren't actually going to change anything. Or, you know, it's kind of like when people are mad at like animal rights activists for showing them footage of what happens to animals in order for them to get on people's plates.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like the anger is directed at KFC for like revealing the truth, even as light of a truth as it is. But it's still like your rage should be placed somewhere else. It maybe should be placed at yourself for consuming this chicken.
Yeah. Good point.
All right. Well, I think it's time for us to move on into a little miniature discussion before we head over to the interview. Paul.
Yes, Andy.
So this is a few weeks old at this point, but we've been so busy we haven't had a chance to talk about it. So I did want to touch on it briefly. And that is that veganism now officially has a flag. And it seems like most people have been pretty positive on this, but I've seen some dissenting opinions. I wanted to suss it out a little bit with you. If you're out there and you haven't seen this flag or heard of this flag before, you can find a link in our show notes that will lead you to an image of this flag. But essentially, it is what I would describe as a white V. And the space above the V is green, and the space below the V is blue. I feel like that's pretty accurate, Paul.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's like a pretty good-looking flag as far as flag design goes.
There's all sorts of rules to flag design, I've learned while researching this, apparently. So this flag was designed by Gad Hakimi, and the colors that I've already mentioned are blue, green, and white, and they're supposed to represent sea, land, and air. And this, let's see here. So before we really talk about it, I'm just going to read a little quote from Gad that in an interview that Gad gave to TiVo News, which we'll include a link to, but you're going to have to do a Google Translate to actually be able to read this interview. But in the interview, when asked about like why he wanted to create this flag, he said, "I want to give from myself and my abilities to promote veganism. I have created a vegan superhero comic. The one thing I lacked was a flag, which will guide the character, his identity, and his colors. I have searched the web for a flag and found nothing besides a few sketches which were designed unprofessionally and were not promoted. They didn't follow the basic rules of creating a flag. I have then decided to design a flag by myself the same way like the rainbow flag for the LGBT movement. The flag will be identified with all vegans, first as a concept and then as mainstream." So, Paul.
Yes.
You've said the flag looks nice. You know, what's kind of your overall impression of this flag and what it represents?
My first response to this was like, I didn't know that that's what this movement was lacking. And I think that's still one of my first, that's my response to it. Because it's like, I guess I don't fully see the necessity of it. Again, I think that it looks cool.
It's calming to look at. It has nice, cool, calming colors.
Yeah, definitely those CCCs. And I don't think that it's necessary. I don't exactly... I guess my first response is that I don't feel like it's going to bolster the movement in any way. I think, vegans are... Even though many vegans, you know, feel isolated because they're the only vegan, you know, that they know. It's like, I don't necessarily think that a flag is the thing that's going to be like, oh, now I don't feel isolated anymore. I own a decent amount of vegan t-shirts, as most of them are at Andy's. And it's like, that's kind of my way where it's like, if I'm out and about, someone will be like, oh, hey, you're vegan. I'm vegan too. And I'll be like, oh, cool. We're both vegan. This is nice. So I guess I just don't necessarily feel that there was a need for it. And I could be completely wrong. There could be many reasons why it's necessary, but I don't know. My first impression is that I don't feel the need for it. I also don't necessarily think that there is a drawback that's so terrible that I would be like, no, you shouldn't do this.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Like, if there's no need for it, is there anything that it could possibly harm veganism by having people flying this flag?
I feel like the one way I could imagine it could do harm is that I'm thinking about some of the types of people that maybe would be the ones that would be like flagrantly waving it around while doing something that I would not necessarily agree with or think is productive, and that just kind of will further, I mean, we talk about these sorts of things, it already instills in the general public like, oh, there's those wacky vegans at it again, like doing these things, and it's already kind of like, oh, there's this negative image placed on vegans. And I worry that the type of people that would be like, oh, we just did this thing, we did this, I don't know, disruption or something like that, that I wouldn't necessarily think is the most productive. And then they, you know, kind of like stick this flag into the ground and be like, this is us, like, this is the thing. And it's all, I think that it makes it so that all of veganism is affected more by the actions of one person or one group of people if there's this kind of like unifying flag. But I guess that's true with any, you know, with any sort of flag bearing movement. But it just seems like more so with veganism, anytime a vegan or a group of vegans do something, it's very much represented as like the whole vegan movement.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I kind of had similar misgivings about the whole thing. I think, to me, first and foremost, when I think about flags, I think about division, I think about nationalism, I think about the military. And obviously not every flag necessarily represents that, but, you know, as far as ones that are representing countries, You know, it just feels like it's more divisive than it needs to be, but I don't have a strong enough reason to dislike this flag that if someone was flying it, I would like feel like I had to have a conversation with them about it or something. Like, to me, it's just one of those things where I'm like, not for me. I think it might be maybe a little divisive and perhaps slightly counterproductive, but I guess, you know, you kind of brought this up, but I'm like, is this any really like ethically or substantially different than someone wearing a t-shirt, which is my livelihood? You know, is a t-shirt not in some way a flag? you know, I guess you could say that like a flag is like one specific symbol that everyone is, you know, in theory gathered under, whereas like t-shirts are, you know, they can have any number of messages. They can represent one cause in, you know, 100 different ways, whereas like the flag is one flag and it's supposed to represent one thing. But like, Paul, do you think, and you said you wear the t-shirts and that's your way of connecting with people, is that different than someone that like drives around with like a vegan flag, you know, in the bed of their pickup truck or something? Like, do you think there's any real meaningful difference?
I can't shake the fact that it feels different, and I think I'm processing this as it comes out of my mouth, Andy. So this might not sound good. Like, I think when I think about someone, you know, flying a flag from their pickup truck, the first flag that comes in my head would be like the Confederate flag, you know, which to me is representative of, well, racism and like nationalism and stuff like that. And when I see people flying flags like that in that way, it rubs me the wrong way. Versus people flying flags at like marches and protests and things like that, which does not rub me the wrong way. And I think in my head, my first thought is the way that people would be flying the vegan flag would be in a way where it would rub me the wrong way. Does that make any sense at all?
It's one of those things where I get what you're saying and I don't really know how to put it into words, but I do get what you're saying.
Let me try to rephrase it. Like, I think the way that people would be flying the flag would be in a way that's like, to me, it seems like this is my identity and it's better than yours type of thing.
So do you think that perhaps this flag makes veganism too much about like vegans and like our identity and not about the animals? Is that kind of what you're getting at? Maybe.
I mean, I certainly think that is another aspect of it that deserves critiquing, because there's nothing, well, I guess if this went mainstream, like if this flag got more coverage, then people would know what it represented. But until that happens, people are just going to see a flag and assume it's like a, I mean, it looks like a country flag. Like it just kind of looks like any other standard flag.
That's because there's rules you got to follow, Paul.
But when people do, when it does get to a point, if it gets to a point where people recognize it as the vegan flag, I think, like you said, Andy, it will just kind of be like, people will think to themselves like, oh, that's a vegan right there. They won't think like, why is that person vegan? They'll just be like, that's a vegan, so maybe I should stay away from that person. Or I don't know, whatever they already think about vegans. But like you said, I think it does maybe take the emphasis off of animals and put it on the human.
Yeah, and that's another interesting thing. I mean, in the interviews, Gad has talked about, you know, should they have an animal on it? Originally, they actually wanted red to seem to represent like the slaughter and the bloodshed that happens. Mm-hmm. And so I imagine they went through like a billion different designs trying to come up with something that actually worked and looked nice and all those things. So, you know, I would hate to crap all over someone's hard work. And I'm sure they had definitely the best intentions in mind when creating this thing. But mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. I don't know. Is it too much to think that maybe there should be something that represents animals on there, because it's, you know, the colors represent land, sky and or water, land and air.
Well, I thought it was, I had read somewhere, I think, that the intention was those colors represent the animals in the sea the animals that fly in the air and the animals that walk on the land.
Ah, interesting. Not in the interview I read, but that would certainly make sense. You know, I've read some articles where various people talked about their interpretations of it and how, you know, the proportions of green to blue represents the proportions of water to land on the earth and all of these things that may not have been intentional, but certainly could apply. But it almost feels like it's more, to me, environmentally, you know, focused than animal focused. But
oh, interesting.
But yeah, I mean, I'm not sure, but I know that for a lot of people right now, veganism represents an environmental awareness, and that's like a big push for a lot of people.
So let me ask you something, Andy. What are the good things that can happen as a result of this flag?
Well, so I mean, I think about what Gad said, the flag will be identified with all the vegans, first as a concept and then as mainstream. And essentially, you know, what I gather is the flag is meant to unify the movement. And so I can't really answer your question, Paul, because I can't think of anything that's like really going to realistically happen that I think will be overwhelmingly positive. I don't think that this flag will unify everyone. I think when I hear about like unifying, I hear people that are kind of trying to get people that have problems within veganism, especially within like the mainstream vegan movement, I should say, as a means of like telling them to like shut up and sit down. Like, we have to be unified mm-hmm. here. We're all under this one flag. And it's like, vegans are not a monolith. There's a wide swath of motivations and ethics and even goals in mind when you consider the big divide between like welfare and abolition and all of that stuff. And that's only just breaking the surface. I don't want every sect of veganism to have their own flag. Then it's just going to even seem, I think, even more, you know, segmented out, and everyone has their own territory and they got to defend a flag. And, you know, a lot of horrible things happen over people defending flags. So I can't really think of anything super positive that will come from this. I think like the best I could say is I feel like it's like a neutral thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm kind of on the same page. Like, it doesn't, to me, it does not seem like something that's going to unify vegans. Like, just having a flag.
Yeah, and then, like, another thing that I kind of wanted to bring up was the quote that said, you know, I've decided to design the flag by myself the same way, like, the rainbow flag of the LGBT movement. But, like, vegans aren't really a marginalized group of people, you know, like I know yeah. there's times when we like to think we are like, oh, we can't find, you know, some cheese that's not Daya, you know, like there's obviously things that are harder for vegans, you know, living life as a vegan is not the easiest thing for a lot of people, especially new and aspiring vegans. And you're dealing with your friends that don't understand and your family that, you know, still tries to feed you fish or like whatever it might be. Like, there's plenty mm-hmm. of very uncomfortable moments. There's lots of questions that you get asked all the time that you would rather not get asked, but we're not a marginalized group. You know, it's like we're a movement made up of allies of a marginalized group, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like an ally flag almost. And like, it, you know, veganism is about us because it's actions that we have to take, but it just feels like the flag makes it too much about us. And it also like puts us in, if especially if like the motivations are comparing it to the pride flag, it feels off to me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I had that same kind of feeling. And again, I think it comes back to like, if people kind of, if people use the flag, the vegan flag, the same way that people like would wave around the LGBT, the rainbow flag at like a pride festival or something like that, like you were kind of saying, it doesn't, that, I don't know, that just doesn't feel right. And it seems like the type of thing that, it seems like the type of people that would be doing that are the same type of people that do something shitty and then say, I did that for the animals.
Perhaps. But, you know, I mean, but then that's just an argument against how certain things are used. And it's like, well, what if the flag could be used responsibly for good?
Spider-Man style.
your friendly neighborhood vegan.
I mean, I don't, just like wearing a vegan t-shirt, like, I don't necessarily think wearing a shirt that has that design on it, you know, would be a negative thing. I mean, we've kind of seen, you know, that little that little plant emoji that looks like a V, or the V inside the circle. Those are both like emblems that you see on a lot of people's social media to kind of show that they are vegan. And I wouldn't necessarily think that those things are bad. It's like a way to quickly identify that you are vegan, which I don't think is a bad thing. But I don't know, again, like the, like if the flag's used like that, I don't think it's that bad, but it just seems like the fact that it is a flag implies something different. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I want to back it up for a second. I don't like it when people have like the V in their Instagram name, or maybe their Facebook name personally.
Well, I don't like you, Andy.
I don't know. I know we've covered this at some point, but I feel like that is like for me, I think there's a lot of importance in still like kind of blending in with your friends and like not showing that if you go vegan, you have to become this alternate person and put a different letter in your Instagram name or your Facebook name or whatever it is. Instagram is I shouldn't say Instagram, because whatever, throw your XVX on there if you want. But like your Facebook, for some reasons, it's to me, it's like you're setting yourself apart. It, you know, there should be plenty of ways to identify someone as vegan without that. And like whenever I get a friend request from someone that has vegan as their middle name, I'm like, I'm going to look at their page and everything they post is just going to be horrible slaughter footage. And I'm not going to want to be friends with this person, or at very least follow their feed, you know?
Yeah, I guess I have the opposite. Like when I'm looking for new friends on Instagram, it's like, that's the thing that I look for. I like go to their page quickly and I look like, do I see that V, or do I see the little plant thing? And nope. All right. Next person.
Refuse to be friends with non-vegans, huh, Paul?
You know me. Yeah. I guess we'll see where this goes. I'm going to be honest. Like, I know we're discussing whether or not, you know, we believe that it should be used or not. I don't really see it catching on. I could be wrong, but I see this kind of fizzling out in a couple weeks.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to report back in a few months and see if it's caught on. Gad certainly is confident that it's going to catch on because of the reaction of friends and family.
In a few months, that'll be the only shirt I wear, and I'll just have like sunglasses that have the the flag as the lenses, and I'll just be driving around a truck with the flag.
You'll be wearing the flag as a cape.
Yeah, and a bathing suit.
And that's it. You'll have it tattooed all over you.
Yep.
Then we'll change our name to the Vegan Flag Cast.
The Bearded Vegan Flags.
Okay. I think we've ran this well dry. Yeah. Have you, beardos out there, have you seen the flag? What do you think of the flag? Are we way off base? Is this going to be like an amazing thing that will unite people? Let us know. You can send us an email, thebeardvegans@gmail.com. And don't go anywhere, because there is still plenty of show left. We will be right back with an interview with Wendy Werneth, who is the Nomadic Vegan. And it's cool to get Wendy on the show, because we have read several of her emails on air before about vegan travel. And this is a little different than the type of interview we normally do, but I think people will get a lot out of it. And it was a lot of fun to chat with Wendy about a variety of issues involved with the struggles, or the how easy it can be to travel as a vegan when you're in countries where you don't speak the language and things like that. So we'll be right back with our interview with Wendy Werneth. Our guest today is Wendy Werneth, who may be better known to our listeners as the Nomadic Vegan. Wendy, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Andy. It's a joy to talk to you.
Yes, it's great to finally get you on the show. A lot of listeners may recognize your name because we've read some emails you've sent in. That's one of the main reasons why we want to bring you on. But we always like to start at the beginning, as you know. So what came first for you? Was it the nomadic life, or was it veganism?
Nomadic life came first. I've loved travel. I always loved travel growing up. I didn't realize that it was going to become such a big part of my lifestyle. But yeah, I definitely had the travel bug early on in childhood. And I grew up in the States, but I left the States 18 years ago now. And initially I thought that was going to be like a 6 month, you know, stint in Europe, and I was going to get it out of my system. And like I said, that was 18 years ago, and it still hasn't stopped yet. I don't think it's ever going to stop. So yeah, nomadic life definitely came first. And then veganism was much later. So it's still pretty recent for me. It will be 3 years in September that I've been vegan, but it feels like so much longer than that. I mean, I know that probably sounds like not long at all to you because you've been vegan for much longer. But yeah, for me, it's also such a huge part of my life now that I can't imagine not being vegan. And yeah, it's really strange to think that it's only been 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, like, I feel like every year that I'm vegan, I'm like, oh, wow, I've been vegan for 6, 7, 8, you know, whatever years.
Uh-huh. And,
but it also almost feels like it's been who I am forever at the same time, even though I obviously had a pre-vegan life. So,
right.
Yeah, I remember even at 3 years in, I was like, I'm in this for life, and I'm so vegan right now, and it just, like, really became a part of my identity.
Right, yeah.
And so nomadic life, that is something that can take so many different shapes. Obviously, some people like myself live in their van.
Right.
What does nomadic life look like for you? How do you practice that?
Yeah, I mean, it's taken different forms over the years because, like I said, it has been 18 years now since I left the U.S., which is kind of crazy. So I have lived and worked and studied and traveled in lots of different countries around the world. I did hit my 100th country a few months ago, so I'm not really big into country counting, but that was a nice, you know, landmark to hit. So I've been to 100 countries. So a lot of that has been, you know, just long-term traveling. Usually, well, I started out on my own, and then I met my husband in 2001. We met in Italy when we were both traveling, and so now we travel together and are very lucky to have found each other, you know, and to have found a life partner that also wants this kind of life, because it's a pretty unorthodox one, and, you know, not many people would want to live like this, although I guess you can probably relate to it.
Yes.
But yeah, so we've done several trips where we've been gone for months at a time, backpacking, budget traveling, where we're just staying in cheap hostels or hotels and, you know, trying to make the money go as far as we can. And then we'll have stints where we would settle down and work for a few months at a time, or maybe, you know, a year or more at a time. For a while, we were both working in sports media. My husband's background is in sports journalism, and so he still does this sometimes. He'll work at major sport events like the Olympic Games or the Rugby World Cup or things like that. And then I kind of got into that through him. Briefly, so, you know, we would be part of the organizing team that would organize these major events, and we'd do, you know, a contract for a few months and save up some money and then go off traveling again. So we did that kind of nomadic lifestyle for several years, and then we thought we were going to settle down. It was in 2010, I was offered a job at the UN in Geneva, Switzerland, and I took that job. And we thought we'd had it out of our system and, you know, we're ready to have a quote-unquote normal life. And after a few years, realized, no, we're just never going to be normal. So we were sedentary for a while. I mean, we still traveled. Everyone, you know, if you look at my Facebook profile, my friends are always like, you're always traveling, because we were, you know, on the weekends, we would always go off somewhere. You know, Geneva is really central in Europe, and so it would be very easy to just go away for a weekend. You know, I still got 6 weeks of paid vacation every year, so we took full advantage of that. So we were still traveling more than most people, but not enough for us. And so at the end of 2016, we both quit our jobs and moved our home base to Lisbon, Portugal. And so now we kind of consider ourselves to be semi-nomadic, and we plan to be in Lisbon roughly 6 months out of the year and then travel the other half of the year.
Very cool. So you're not going to change the website to the semi-nomadicvegan.com?
I don't think it has the same ring to it. What do you think?
Yeah, I like the nomadicvegan.com. And so speaking of veganism, so 3 years ago, what brought you to veganism? What did that journey look like for you?
Mm-hmm. It started through health for me, actually, which is funny to look back on because now my main motivation is very much the animals. But what drew me to it was an interest in health. And my father had passed away somewhat recently from complications from type 1 diabetes. And I saw him die a very slow and painful death and knew that I didn't want to end up like that. So I suddenly became more interested than I had been in my own personal health. And somehow I ended up watching an online summit. It's called the Food Revolution Summit by John and Ocean Robbins. I don't know if you're familiar with it, Andy. But it's something that they do every year. John Robbins, of course, is the author of Diet for a New America. So he's been kind of preaching the benefits of a plant-based diet for a long time. And he and his son, every year, they organize this summit where they bring in lots of guest speakers. And they're, you know, the guys that you see all the time in the documentaries, the Esselstyns and all those people. So this was my first introduction to these people. I'd never heard of them before, never really heard of a plant-based diet before. And so I listened to several of those interviews, and they did have an impact on me. Although now the one that I remember the most is the interview with Alicia Silverstone, who is also vegan. And she was talking more about the animals because that's her main motivation. And Alicia Silverstone, that was a name that I already knew. And, you know, she was someone that I had kind of idolized in my teenage years. And so I paid attention to that. And then, I don't know if you want to call it serendipity or fate, but it was just a few days later, I was at a used book sale and I saw her book there, which is called The Kind Diet. And so I picked it up, and that's what really got me started on this journey. And I'm so thankful to her for writing this book and for writing it the way that she did, because it was just so approachable. At that point, I thought, well, there's no way that I can ever be vegan, like completely vegan. That just sounded, you know, totally out of the realm of possibility. But she wrote the book in a way that, you know, you didn't have to go into it thinking, I'm going to be vegan. You just, you know, you could take baby steps and just play with it and, you know, experiment with it. And that's how it started out. And then, you know, I gradually transitioned over a few months. And for a while, I was doing Vegan Before Six, which, you know, Mark Bittman is the one who, he wrote a book called VB6, which I haven't read the book, but I heard the term somewhere and I thought, oh, well, that sounds like something that I could do. I could eat, you know, two vegan meals a day and then I could have a non-vegan meal for dinner. And I thought that that was as far as it was going to go. But the more that I educated myself, the more that I learned about what happens to the animals in particularly the dairy and the egg industries, because at that point I was basically doing vegetarian for my dinner as well and then doing vegan for my other two meals. And I thought, no, this just doesn't make sense. I have to be vegan. That's the only way that I can really live in alignment with my own values and be true to myself and, you know, be happy with myself. So the two things that had been holding me back was, one, I knew that my husband was going to freak out, which he did. and two, I was afraid that it was going to ruin travel. And, you know, like I talked about, travel was a huge part of my life. And I just didn't even know if it was possible to find vegan food in some of the places that I wanted to go to and some of the places that I had already been. And I just thought, at the very least, it's going to be a gigantic hassle. And, you know, I'm probably going to end up really unhealthy and eating fries all the time because I can't find anything else. And, you know, I thought it was going to be a disaster. And so that was what was holding me back for a long time. And then we had a trip that we'd already booked months in advance to go to Greece. So we were going to Greece for 3 weeks. And I thought, all right, I'm going to give it a trial run. So I'm going to see if I can eat only vegan for the 3 weeks that I'm in Greece. And if I can, then I might have to, you know, reevaluate my perceptions of how difficult vegan travel really is. And if I can do it when I'm traveling, then I'm going to have to start doing it all the time when I'm at home, too. Our flight landed in Greece, and that was September 10th, 2014, and that is my veganiversary. So I never looked back. It was so easy, actually. I mean, I did do some research before we arrived, and I found a couple of blogs. Didn't find that much, but I found enough information to let me think that, okay, maybe there are some options. Maybe it's not quite as difficult as you thought it was. And then I got there, and the options were everywhere. Like, it was just unbelievable. I was trying a new dish every day for, like, the first 2 weeks at least. So I was completely blown away by the abundance of vegan food that was available. And, yeah, like I said, never looked back.
That's so cool to hear. I think... I can speak for myself and probably a lot of people that, you know, you get worried about traveling abroad because you're worried that you're not going to find food, or you're not going to find, you know, you have a language barrier or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So that's so much of your mission. But before we get into that, just to harp on something you just said about realizing that there was all this abundance on the bio on your website, you wrote that you thought, vegan traveling while vegan would ruin travel for you. But then you said you found it actually made it so much better to travel while vegan. So what exactly do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's really true. I honestly enjoy my travels even more now than I did before I was vegan. And there are several different ways. I mean, veganism has made travel more fulfilling for me in a few different ways. I mean, one is I really enjoy, you know, researching the cuisines, looking for the vegan options so that I'll know what I might have available to me when I'm there. And I found that that's something that I really enjoy. And now, you know, I'm doing it because I want to put it up on the website and be able to share that information with other people. And I find that, you know, I uncover these vegan treasures that were there all along, that are traditional dishes that are part of the local cuisine, that tourists who go to these countries don't normally know about. So I found that veganism, you know, opens up this new window where I can explore the cuisine and also the culture more generally from a whole different viewpoint. I get this, you know, different angle that most people don't see. So, you know, as one example, when I was researching Greek food to see what options there might be available, I learned that the Greek Orthodox Church has a very strong fasting tradition. And when they say fasting, it doesn't mean that you don't eat at all. It just means that you follow certain requirements and you're eating a mostly vegan diet. There's a couple of exceptions. They do eat honey when they're fasting, and they also eat some aquatic animals, not fish, but other animals like shrimp and octopus. But no dairy, no eggs, and no land animals. So because of this, there are lots of traditional dishes, you know, that have grown up. The cuisine has become a very vegan-friendly cuisine because of this fasting tradition. And that's something that I wouldn't have known about if I hadn't been looking for the vegan food. So I ended up learning a lot more about the culture beyond just the cuisine. So, yeah, there's that. There's the fact that I feel like I'm on a treasure hunt now when I'm traveling. Like, I'm always on the lookout, you know, for whether it's a local specialty that happens to be vegan, or whether it's, you know, a restaurant that's advertising vegan cake or, you know, other vegan options on its signs. I'm constantly on the lookout and I'm constantly finding things. And, you know, the problem that I have is the opposite of what I thought I was going to have. You know, like, I thought that there weren't going to be any options and I was going to have to starve, or I was going to have to just eat French fries. And in reality, I'm finding so many things that I don't even have the time to try them all, you know. And I keep seeing something, I'm like, oh, I'm not hungry, I just ate, but I really want to try this vegan cake. And, you know, I have to write about it for the blog. So, yeah, I mean, those are just a couple of the ways that, honestly, being vegan really has made travel more enjoyable for me.
I love to hear that. I can relate to that even just from, like, traveling in the U.S. and you're kind of going to a restaurant and you're like, well, when's the next time I'm going to be here? I got to try all of these things, but I can't eat all these things because I'm by myself or with one other person. And I can only imagine that's intensified if you're passing through a country that you're not going to probably won't be visiting, you know, again in the next couple of years or something.
Right.
So yeah, I love looking at it like that, like the treasure hunt aspect. So the main reason we wanted to get you on the show and one of the reasons why you contacted us is that we did an episode, episode 74, and in it we talked about this article which said, can you maintain a vegan diet while traveling? Yes, but it will take some strategizing. And this article focused on a woman named Jeanette who was traveling the Camino de Santiago. And despite her best, her plans and research, she found herself having trouble sticking to a vegan diet. And this was an episode, we got a lot of response on this one. A lot of people had their own opinions on if she did it right or wrong, or if we should judge her, and all of those things. And you wrote in with your opinion on this, but more interestingly, you said that you were actually going to be hiking the Camino de Santiago and would be happy to report your findings. So that's why we brought you on. You recently completed that journey.
So
before we really get into it, could you explain to the listeners what the Camino is?
Yeah, sure. So the Camino de Santiago is a medieval pilgrimage route that goes, well, it can go all the way across Spain, but really it can start from wherever you want it to start. And of course, in medieval times, when people were doing this for religious reasons, they would just start by walking out their front door. So you would have people coming from all over Europe and then converging in a city which is called Santiago de Compostela, which is in the far northwest of Spain, and that's where the remains, the relics of Saint James are said to be kept, so the Apostle James. So that, for Catholics who are doing it for religious reasons, that is kind of the goal of the walk, is to arrive and, you know, venerate the relics of St. James. But there are lots of people nowadays who do the Camino not for religious reasons, but for various other reasons, whether it's just a hike, which I would actually say if you're just in it to go on a long hike, there are probably better hikes that you can do. But, you know, they might be interested in the cultural aspects. There's, you know, lots of history and architecture and art to be seen along the way. It's a very interesting way to travel, you know, to see parts of Spain that you wouldn't otherwise go to if you were just traveling by train or bus or car or whatever. So it's quite a popular walk, probably not as well known among Americans as it is among Europeans, just because it's much further away. But there are more and more people every year who are doing the Camino de Santiago, and starting nowadays, the most popular starting point is in a little village in France, which is where I started. It's called Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, and so it's in the Pyrenees Mountains, just across the border from Spain. And then on the first day of the walk, you would walk across the Pyrenees Mountains and then cross the border into Spain and then walk all the way, pretty much all the way across Spain. Santiago is pretty close to the, you know, the far western border. And some people do continue on to a place called Finisterra, which literally means the end of the earth. So then you are walking all the way to the coast, and that takes an extra 3 days or so. But if you just walk from Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port to Santiago, which is what I did, then it's about 800 kilometers. And sorry, I don't know what that is in miles. I've been away from the U.S. for too long. I can't do conversions anymore. But it took me 39 days to walk that, just to give you an idea. And I was a little bit slow, actually, because I was having some injuries, some problems with my feet that were slowing me down. So some people would do it in maybe 31 or 32 days. At 35 would maybe be more average, and I did it in 39.
Right on. And for the listeners, just did some quick calculation. That would be 497 miles. So that is quite a trek. And tell us about your experience on this trail as it pertains to finding vegan food along the way.
Sure. Well, my experience was quite positive. And again, this is just my personal experience. And I know that other vegans on the Camino have had a very different experience. And I can talk in a minute, if you want, about why that might be and what advantages I might have had over other people. But yeah, my personal experience was that I had no trouble at all finding vegan food. And I wasn't really worried about it going into it, because that's always been my experience from the beginning, you know, from that first trip in Greece. I found that, yeah, some places are more vegan friendly than others, but there's always a way to make it work, and it's never as hard as some things that you read on the internet might lead you to believe. So, you know, I wasn't worried. I knew that I wasn't going to starve, but it was even easier than I thought. And I mean, I wouldn't even say easy, because it wasn't hard at all. Like I was surprised that there were actually quite a few vegetarian hostels. They're called albergues in Spanish. So they're kind of like youth hostels, except they're pilgrim hostels. So they're specifically for pilgrims. The people who walk the Camino are referred to as pilgrims. And they're particularly in the last 2 weeks or so, like the last 300 kilometers or so, there were quite a few vegetarian hostels who only served vegetarian food. And that was something that I was not expecting at all. So I thought that we would probably, my husband and I walked this together, and he's also vegan now. And so I thought that we would end up cooking a lot of our own meals. And, you know, I thought, yeah, we'll find a way to make it work. Like, we'll just buy some chickpeas and some vegetables from the store or whatever. But that wasn't necessary. We cooked a total of 5 times out of the 39 days. And the rest of the time, we were just eating in restaurants. And I mean, either restaurants or the hostels. And, yeah, found plenty of food.
Right on. And so why do you think others might have had a harder time than you?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I don't want to just say, oh, it's easy. And, you know, if you think it's hard, then you're wrong, because I thought it was easy. You know, there are different things that come into play. And like, for example, the woman Jeanette, who was referred to in the interview, you know, she really did put in a lot of effort. If you read the interview, the article that you referred to in the episode, the original episode, she talked about how she mailed herself protein powder to different stops along the way so that she could pick it up when she arrived there. Which, you know, that takes a lot of pre-planning, and she was definitely trying really hard. But I think those efforts were perhaps misguided, or, you know, the things that she was doing were perhaps not the most effective ways that she could have been preparing and planning. So, yeah, I mean, for example, when you're using protein powder, that sounds to me like maybe you're still kind of buying into the protein myth and, you know, think that you need to get a lot of protein. I mean, it's true. I didn't eat a lot of protein-rich foods on the Camino, but that wasn't really something that I was concerned about, because, you know, from the research I've done, my understanding is that we don't need nearly as much protein as people tell us we need. And, you know, I know that I wasn't eating a perfectly balanced diet. Like, my calcium intake was probably low, because normally I get calcium mainly from fortified soy milk and from dark leafy green vegetables that I put in my smoothies. And I wasn't having that stuff on the Camino. So, yeah, I'm sure that I didn't get a completely balanced diet, but also, in that same article, there was a doctor, a plant-based doctor, who talked at the end about how, you know, our bodies are very resilient, and you don't really need to worry about a nutrient deficiency if you're just eating, you know, if you're lacking something for a few days or even for a few weeks. Like, your body can bounce back from that. So, yeah, I wasn't overly concerned about protein and other nutritional needs like that. Also, I do speak Spanish pretty fluently, and that is a huge advantage. And yeah, there are a lot of non-vegans who I saw struggling to deal with the language barrier as well. You know, that's not specific to veganism. Lots of people were, you know, having communication problems when they were trying to order food. But yeah, if you have a specific need, like being vegan, and you're trying to get that across and you don't have the words to do it, then yeah, that's definitely a disadvantage. And then just general expectations. I think I was also at an advantage because when I became vegan, I was living in Geneva, Switzerland, which is a city that's not really very veggie friendly at all. So I'm totally used to going to restaurants and people not knowing what veganism is, you know, there not being any veggie options marked on the menu. Perhaps there aren't really any veggie options on the menu and I have to ask if the chef can make something, you know, special for me. Like, that's my normal, pretty much. Or at least it was when I was living in Geneva. And so, you know, depending on what your normal is, like for you, Andy, someone who lives his life going from one veg fest to another. And I mean, I know that you do pass through a lot of other parts of the country that are not very veggie friendly. But, you know, sometimes I laugh when I listen to the food segment of the podcast and you're talking to Paul and you'll say things like, oh, you know, I don't get too excited about a vegan Thai restaurant because they're a dime a dozen or, you know, daya cheese on my pizza is just not doing it for me because all the pizzerias, they have daya cheese and you got to up your game. And I'm just like, wow, Andy and I live in totally different worlds.
You're most definitely spoiled. I certainly am. I am certainly very spoiled in terms of the options available to me. I will readily admit that.
Right. So for listeners, you know, who live in a place like that where, you know, vegan Thai restaurants are a dime a dozen, then trying to eat out in rural Spain is going to come as a shock and you're going to definitely need to adjust your expectations there. So that was also an advantage I had. And also I have been to Spain lots of times, probably 10 or 12 times before this trip and, you know, have done all this research. I had already written a post on my blog called The Ultimate Vegan Guide to Spain, where I had listed, you know, all of the vegan options that are part of traditional Spanish cuisine. So I knew the cuisine inside and out, and I knew exactly what dishes to look for on the menu and which ones are already vegan and which ones are maybe vegan, but you have to ask certain questions to be sure, you know, and most people are not going to have that background knowledge. And so that's going to be a disadvantage as well. So, you know, I met probably four or five. I met a handful of vegans, other vegans who were walking the Camino or had already walked it and had come back to volunteer in one of the hostels, as they're called, an hospitalero. And that's kind of a common thing for people to do. So I met a couple who was doing that and some others who were walking. And I also met some vegetarians, and a lot of them were really struggling. And unfortunately, a couple of the vegans who I met had gone back to eating eggs while they were on the Camino because they just didn't know what else to eat. And then also one of the vegetarians who I met had gone back to eating fish while he was on the Camino because, again, he didn't know what else to eat. And even the ones who I met who had not done that, who had stuck to their morals, they were doing it, you know, with great difficulty. I remember having a conversation with a young American girl from California who was vegan, and I was asking her, you know, what have you been eating? And she said, oh, you know, yesterday I ate some peas straight out of a tin can that I bought at the supermarket. And I was like, wow, you know, I would never resort to that. I mean, I kind of hate peas anyway, so that wouldn't have been what I would have chosen. So that just sounded really gross to me. But, you know, she obviously didn't know how to access the options that were available to her. So, yeah, those are a few ways that, yeah, it might not be as easy for you. And So I have written a blog post, which maybe you can share it in the show notes if you want. That was the first thing that I did as soon as I got back, like literally 5 minutes after I arrived back in my apartment in Lisbon. I recorded a video just giving my top tips about eating vegan on the Camino, and then I turned that into a blog post as well and gave some further information, because this information is really not out there. I mean, it is now because I've just put it out there, but I didn't find it when I was, you know, doing the research and trying to find out about vegan options on the Camino. And they really are out there, but yeah, it's just a matter of having the tools and the knowledge and the skills, you know, to access them. So I want to try to even the playing field and, you know, help some other people overcome these barriers that they might have.
Yeah, if only there was some book that gathered all of this knowledge into one easy-to-digest place.
Wouldn't that be great?
It would be a great idea. Oh, you know, I'm reading right here. It says that there such a book exists. And that's another reason why I wanted to have you on in this timely manner, is because in addition to your website, thenomadicvegan.com, you've also just put out this book. Came out on July 21st. It's called Veggie Planet, Uncovering the Vegan Treasures Hiding in Your Favorite World Cuisines. And mm-hmm. So I think at this point it'll be obvious to a lot of people, but, you know, tell us what you can find in this book and who you think it will be useful for.
Sure, I'd love to. So in the book, I have chosen 11 of the world's most popular cuisines. So just think of Chinese and Italian, Indian, Middle Eastern, you know, all the ones that people love and, you know, are most likely to come across both in their hometown and when they're traveling, even if they're not traveling to those exact countries. You know, even if you're not in China, you can pretty much always find a Chinese restaurant. You can find one, you know, if you're in Germany, for example. So yeah, I focused on the most popular cuisines and uncovered some of those traditional specialties that happen to be vegan. And, you know, also give a little bit of background about the history and the culture and how that ties in with this cuisine being vegan friendly, and just show how vegan friendly these cuisines really are and what these options are that are available to people. So, and I think this book would be good for, honestly, any vegan who eats out. And, you know, anyone, even if you're not totally vegan, if you're just working towards this lifestyle and, you know, want to include more plant-based meals into your life, including when you're eating out or at home, too. I mean, you can also make these dishes when you're at home. But that's why I focused, like I said, on the most popular cuisines, was because I wanted it to be about foods that people can find anywhere, even if you're not a big traveler. But if you enjoy eating out in your own hometown, now you can know what kind of restaurants to go to and what you can look for when you're there.
Yeah, and I love that the book is not just simply a list of, oh, you go to Spain, these are the things you can eat. You actually explain, you know, the history behind things. You explain certain mm-hmm. aspects of the culture that might not be obvious to someone that's traveling through. So I actually found it just to be an entertaining read, just from like a standpoint of learning about various cultures around the world as it pertains to their food. So even if someone doesn't eat out, I actually was like, this would probably be pretty interesting to someone if they wanted to learn a little bit more about the world around them.
Yeah, thank you so much for saying that. I appreciate that.
I guess this kind of speaks to the whole theme of everything, but, you know, as this book kind of relates to the article we've been talking about Jeanette's experience on the Camino, mm-hmm. one of the kind of the conclusions of the article, the author says, the experience left her fed up with what she calls vegan unfriendly countries. In the future, she said, I'm only going to do vacation destinations where they cater to vegans. And so, you know, you've acknowledged that certain areas don't necessarily cater to vegans, but I do kind of worry that this kind of sentiment kind of plays into, I don't know, like a little bit of xenophobia, or this kind of this view that like the rest of the world doesn't care about animals, or they don't have, you know, vegan options out there. And then the first chapter in your book is the world is more vegan friendly than you think.
Yes. So
would you say that's kind of like part of the mission, or like, what do you mean by that?
Yes, I would say that as part of my mission is to show that the world is more vegan friendly than we think. I mean, even in places where there may not be a strong vegan movement, the vegan movement is growing all over the world. But, you know, it may not be as strong as it is where you live. But nevertheless, there are, you know, religious reasons or geographic reasons or just various cultural reasons why people have incorporated a lot of plant-based dishes into their culture and into their cuisine. And so, yeah, I'm really trying to highlight those. I'm definitely not just focusing on, you know, places that have lots of vegan restaurants, you know, which that would be a whole different book, you know, and then I could talk about Berlin, which is often called the vegan Mecca of Europe, because, you know, there's a strong burgeoning movement there, and that's fantastic. But, you know, I'm trying to show that actually most traditional cuisines are much more plant-based than our own American cuisine. You know, I mean, our traditional idea of a meal would be a big hunk of meat in the center of the plate and then maybe some mashed potatoes and some other vegetable on the side, you know, but the vegetables are always relegated to the side and the meat is the main focus of the dish. And in other cuisines around the world, that's not how they eat at all. And, you know, the vegetables and grains and legumes are often the focus. And then the meat, yeah, it is there, but it's used, you know, very sparingly just to kind of flavor the dish more than anything else, which, of course, is a much more sustainable way of living than what our culture as a whole is doing right now.
Right on. And so as we're coming to close to the end of our time, I'm wondering if you have a favorite country for vegan cuisine that might be kind of unexpected for the listeners. I know you already talked about Greece, and you say that in the book as well. A lot of people are kind of shocked to learn how vegan friendly it is. Are there any other ones that you think people like need to know about?
There are several, but I will choose one. I don't know if this is what you're trying to get me to say or not, Andy, because this is something that I have commented on in the past, commenting on your blog post, or I think I sent in an email and you read it. But yes, I'm going to say Italian cuisine is one that is very misunderstood. And it's unfortunate because the way that Italian cuisine has been exported to the U.S. in particular is true. It's not very vegan friendly. You know, everything is smothered in cheese and it's all about the pepperoni pizza. And that's just not real Italian cuisine. And again, Italian cuisine is a big, big, big umbrella term, and some people say that there's actually no such thing as Italian cuisine because it's very varied. It changes so much from region to region and even city to city and town to town. They all have their own special local dishes and special ways of doing things. But the south of Italy in particular, the local diet there is just very plant-based. And that Italy has a very special place in my heart. I don't know if I mentioned, it's where my husband Nick and I met, and we went back and got married there several years later. And I love the country, and I also love the food. And yeah, I really want to show people that Italian food is not just, you know, the meats and the cheese, and pepperoni pizza is not really a thing. I mean, you know, it's definitely not the most common type of pizza in Italy. The most common types of pizza in Italy are, one is vegetarian, one is vegan. So you have the pizza margherita, which is basically a cheese pizza with mozzarella cheese and tomato sauce and some basil. And then you have the pizza marinara, which is the very first original pizza. And it's totally vegan. There's no cheese at all. It's just tomato sauce and some dried oregano, some garlic, and maybe some basil on there as well. And that's it. And Italian food is very, very simple food. And a lot of times you'll only have just 5 or 6 ingredients, like in the case of a pizza marinara. But those ingredients are going to be super fresh. They're going to be, you know, the very highest quality ingredients that they can find, and that's what really makes all the difference and gives it all the flavor. So yeah, I do have a lot to say about Italian cuisine, and I know I wrote in a long time ago and said that I was writing a book about Italian cuisine, and then it kind of morphed into Veggie Planet instead, where I wanted to talk not just about Italy but about all of these other cuisines. But I do have another book in the works, which is called Italy for Veggie Lovers, and I am going to go into a lot more depth there. But yeah, I did of course include a chapter on Italy in Veggie Planet as well.
Perfect. Can't wait to dig into that new book whenever it comes out. Well, yeah. Wendy, thank you for joining us. How can our listeners follow along with your work? What social media should they be checking out? And what's the best place to pick up the new book?
Yeah, you can find me at thenomadicvegan.com. So that's my main home on the internet. And then I'm on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. Those are my main social media platforms. So on Facebook, I'm just Nomadic Vegan. And Instagram and Twitter is Nomadic_vegan. The book you can find on Amazon. Definitely in the ebook version, and this should be the paperback version as well by the time this airs. And yeah, that's it. Feel free to email me if you have any questions. You can find the contact page on my website. And, you know, I love to share information as much as I can and make vegan travel accessible to people.
Fantastic. Well, once again, the book is called Veggie Planet, Uncovering the Vegan Treasures Hiding in Your Favorite World Cuisines. Wendy, the Nomadic Vegan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Andy. This was so much fun.
So I hope you enjoyed that interview with Wendy. As always, we're always looking for you to give us some feedback. So head over to the Instagram, The Bearded Vegans. Hit us up on Facebook, The Bearded Vegans. You can send us an email, thebeardedvegans@gmail.com, and let us know what you think of the discussions that we had today. Always love hearing you, hearing from you. What do you got coming up, Andy?
Well, Paul, we will be together at the Animal Rights Conference in Washington, D.C., August 3rd through the 6th. Which should be...
That's like tomorrow.
Yeah, it's like tomorrow, if you listen to this in a timely fashion. The weekend after that, I'll be at the Hudson Valley Vegan Food Festival in Newburgh, New York, September 2nd. Paul, you're going to be at the DC Veg Fest in Washington, DC. September 16th, yep. I'll be speaking at the NEPA Veg Fest in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And September 30th, I'll be at the Phoenixville Veg Fest in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. So come on out to all of those. I'll be behind the Compassion Company table. Just look for the vegan shirts, and hopefully I'll be the one selling them to you. You can find all those dates, deeds, and links at compassionco.com.
And maybe some new vegan flags, too.
It's a market that has yet to be cornered, Paul.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Paul, in researching like the rules of flag making, it's actually very, very strict. Like, there's a lot of things you can't do to like make something like legally a flag.
Yes.
And I was like shocked to learn a few different things, but the one that was like the most bizarre to me was that on every flag, like regardless of nation, they have to have the following 7 words just stitched into the hem of the flag.
We are the Bearded Vegan, signing off.
And so at Compassion Fest, bearders were out. Bearders? And this article is titled, Humane Milk is a Myth, Vegan Asver... This article is titled, Humane Milk is a Myth, Veganism... Calves were separated from their mothers. And the AC just kicked on behind me. Hold on.
Oh, no. Never mind. Sorry. The erase that. It's so hard to say advert. Just an awkward word. was kind of digging this video, or would kind of have digged the video, dug the video. I don't know. So let me ask you something, Andy.
No.
What are the... With great vegan flags comes great... I don't know. Edit that out. like I was saying, I don't... Maybe I did say this. I shouldn't say like I was saying. Edit that out. We are the Bearded Vegans, signing off. Sometimes in Latin.